Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The Battle of Gaugamela, also known as the Battle of Arbela, Part 2 of 2. Last week, I described the build-up to the invasion by Alexander the Great against the Persians. When he inherited the throne of Macedon, Alexander was 20 years old, and only 2 years later, he was on the verge of launching an army into the heart of what had been the superpower of the known world. He acted with the impulsiveness of youth, yet proved to be a remarkable leader of men. In 334 BC, Alexander's army marched into Asia with approximately 48,000 soldiers and 6,000 cavalry drawn from Macedon, Thrace, Illyria, and various Greek city-states. This was a good-sized army for such an expedition. Any larger may have proved too unwieldy. The equipment of the Greek soldiers had developed since the Battle of Marathon. Whereas the hoplites of past wore heavy armour and carried short thrusting spears, Alexander's troops were lighter armed and used far longer spears. This had the effect of increasing the offensive capability of the infantry units by having several rows of spearheads projecting from the front of the formation. It also increased the manoeuvrability and the speed at which the troops could move. This meant that they could march at a far greater rate each day and thus cover more ground. Alexander also made far greater use of cavalry than was traditional in Greek warfare. The first major military engagement came in late spring at the Granicus River, where Alexander met the local Persian forces in a closely fought battle. The Greek and Macedonian cavalry won the day by charging across the river and up the bank to rout the opposing Persians. Having Alexander leading his troops from the front was an effective but risky strategy. During the battle, one Persian warrior came within a split second of cleaving Alexander's head in two with a sword, but just in time, a Macedonian commander saved his king by slicing off the attacker's arm. Their campaign could have ended after it had scarcely begun. But after the Greek victory, the Anatolian cities of Sardis, Ephesus, and Magnesia opened their gates to Alexander with no resistance, while Miletus and Halicarnassus were taken after some resistance. From there, Alexander proceeded along the southern coast of Asia Minor. On the way, he made a detour to Gordium, where an oracle was said to have promised the lordship of Asia to whoever could undo a seemingly impenetrable knot of rope. Alexander, so the story goes, showing his direct style, raised his sword and cut straight through the Gordian knot with one blow. Alexander finally met the Persian king of kings, Darius III, and the main Persian force at the ancient town of Issus, situated at a pass in the Taurus mountain, right in the corner of the Mediterranean, where the southern coast of Anatolia turns round down to modern-day Syria and Lebanon. Darius led his men in a surprise march behind the Macedonian advance to cut their line of supply, forcing Alexander to countermarch. It was a good plan, but Alexander's cavalry turned the battle when they charged directly against Darius and his chariot. The battle is captured in a famous mosaic which is held in the National Museum of Naples and which you can see on the History of Europe Key Battles website, www.historyeurope.net. The Persian king was forced to flee, leaving behind his wives and daughters who had accompanied his campaign. Alexander treated his hostages well, and this sign of compassion boosted his reputation among the peoples of the Persian Empire. The other side of Alexander's character was that when defied, he was utterly ruthless. The cities of Tyre and Gaza resisted months of siege against him, and when the walls were eventually breached, thousands of their inhabitants were massacred and the survivors enslaved. Hearing of this must have helped persuade the satrap of Egypt not to fight when Alexander now headed to his capital, Memphis. In fact, a welcome pageant was staged in which Alexander was treated as a liberator. It may seem like a large, unnecessary diversion for the Greeks to, at this point, turn away from their main target of central Persia and give Darius the time to recover his forces and rebuild his defences. In part, this decision was based on strategic reasons. Alexander wished to secure the Egyptian province before marching further east, and so avoid the risk of enemy forces behind him. But Alexander was also keen to visit the shrine of the god Ammon in the Libyan desert. Here, the signs at the temple were favourable to Alexander, who was addressed as the son of Ammon, a title given to any pharaoh. What's more interesting is how Alexander interpreted his new title. It appears that he was not only going through the motions of accepting the title, but thereafter he seriously began to entertain the belief that he was divine. A practical necessity now, however, was dealing with Darius III, who Alexander would meet once more in what proved to be the decisive battle at Gaugamela. So in the spring of 331, Alexander led his rested army northeast out of Egypt and towards the heartland of Persia. En route, he received diplomatic proposals from Darius. The precise terms are unclear in the sources, but it seems Darius offered Alexander the western half of his empire and a marriage alliance with the king's daughter. Perhaps this was just a tactic to buy time, but it was clear Darius was keen to avoid another battle. There must have been some Macedonians who attempted to accept. It is said one of Alexander's generals, Parmenion, said that if he were Alexander, he would gladly accept the more than generous offer. Alexander replied, "And I would too, if I were Parmenion." Alexander flatly rejected the offer and demanded Darius recognise him now as king of Asia. So Darius awaited his foe in a strategic position near the headwaters of the River Tigris, northeast of Mosul. The chosen spot took best advantage of both Persian cavalry and his overall numerical advantage. Meanwhile, Alexander and his army were marching a long way through hostile terrain, still very warm in mid-September. This was made more difficult by Darius ordering a force to lay waste to the land the Macedonians would have to pass through. The Greeks found too little food to feed themselves properly, but not so little that they were forced to turn back. Circumstances were more in Darius's favour than earlier at Issus. He had managed to guide the enemy to the battlefield of their choice, and had a good number of well-rested troops who had been organised on the battlefield properly. As always for ancient armies, it is very difficult to be confident on precise numbers. Darius may have had 250,000 soldiers, including more than 42,000 cavalry, against approximately 47,000 soldiers from Alexander, with around 6,000 cavalry. When the sun rose on the 30th of September, the day of the battle, Darius sent scouts to the far side of the field to study his opponent's battle formation. It looked similar to their formation at Issus. In the Macedonian centre was the phalanx, and on the right wing stood the infantry, the companion cavalry with Alexander, and the light cavalry. On the left wing, commanded by Parmenion, stood the Greek and Thracian horsemen. A second line, invisible to the Persians, consisted of Greek troops and lightly armoured soldiers who were to intervene if the Persians attempted a flanking movement. As for the Persian army, the Greek historian Xenophon describes the numerous races that made up the Persian army. Indians, Medes, Babylonians, the Sakai and Bactrians from Central Asia, Armenians, Cappadocians from Asia Minor, and also Greek mercenaries. The Greek mercenaries were placed on either side of Darius in the centre in order to counter the Macedonian phalanx. As for the action, The sources give us glimpses of the rival forces facing each other through clouds of dust and over wheeling horses. The Sacae and the Bactrians made serious headway into the Macedonians. Also, the Persian cavalry managed to break through battle lines and raid the Macedonian base camp. However, Alexander again led the charge through the centre of battle, deliberately manoeuvring to open a gap in the enemy lines. With his companions, he drove a wedge into the Persian left wing, who were forced backwards. Darius felt in personal danger and opted, as in Issus, to flee the battleground, prompting the rest of his army to follow. Since antiquity, this moment has been recognised as a turning point in history, when the mighty Persia fell and the Greeks came to dominate the Middle East. It was represented in a famous 18th century Flemish tapestry, part of which I have used as the logo for this podcast, with Alexander, spear in hand. After the battle, the Persian baggage train was rounded up. In his victory so far, Alexander had already inherited great wealth, on a scale formerly unknown to the Greeks. But Darius was still on the loose and needed to be dealt with, so Alexander pursued him. The Persian king's power was now disintegrating. The balance of power had swung firmly in favour of Alexander, as the heart of the empire fell under his control. The satrap of Babylon, seeing the way the wind was blowing, staged a ceremonial welcome for the conqueror and his troops. And Alexander, as recorded in a discovered cuneiform tablet, treated the citizens well, assuring them that their homes would not be invaded and that the city's premier sanctuary would be restored. Darius's only hope was to organise resistance from the Iranian plateau and Central Asia, but this time he would not be allowed time to regroup. Alexander was very keen to finish him off, to confirm his position as King of Asia by eliminating the incumbent. So at the end of 331, he pressed eastwards into the Zagros Mountains, despite the winter weather. There, Alexander won another battle against local resistance and captured both the ancient capital of Persia, Persepolis, and its winter capital, Susa. There were still large tracts of land in the north and east which could have offered resistance. However, Darius was quickly losing supporters, and the suitability of his leadership came increasingly in question. In an obscure and later romanticised episode, some high-ranking nobles held a coup and killed the king. One of the conspirators, Bessus, declared himself the new king, Artaxerxes V, though his legitimacy would have been difficult to secure at the best of times. For Alexander, this was an anticlimax. He liked to portray the war, in part in terms of a personal rivalry between two great kings. But he put aside his disappointment and cleverly spun the killing of Darius to his advantage. He declared himself Darius' successor and now vowed to avenge his rival's murder, just as he had now succeeded in avenging the Greeks for the Persian aggression a century and a half before. Alexander saw Darius' dead body and took the signet ring off the dead king's finger. Afterwards, he sent Darius' body back to Persepolis, gave him a magnificent funeral, and ordered that he be buried, like all his royal predecessors, in the royal tombs. Darius is portrayed in the Greek sources as a weak ruler, lacking the qualities required by his vast empire during a period of crisis. He fled the battles of Issus and Gaugamela when stronger commanders would have stood their ground. But in truth, it is very difficult to fairly pass judgment on him based on biased sources and to know whether another individual would have been more successful at defending the empire against the invasion. Alexander led his army further east, creating an empire stretching from the Adriatic Sea to the Indus River. He continued his policy of ruthlessly putting down any resistance while acting benevolently towards those who immediately submitted to his command. It was only when his army, worn out after years of campaigning in hostile terrain, refused to go any further that Alexander reluctantly stopped the march eastwards. On his journey back home, Alexander marched south down the Indus River. Along the way, he took out his frustration by conquering Indian tribes who resisted him and by risking his life more flamboyantly than ever before, flinging himself over the wall of an Indian town to face the enemy alone. His horrified officers were barely able to rescue him in time. The Macedonian troops were not only unhappy about the long, arduous march or their leader's apparent recklessness. They were uncomfortable about the degree to which Alexander was adopting the Persian culture. It was understandable that he wished to present an image to the conquered peoples, tailored to the local cultures, such as his self-portrayal as the new pharaoh in Egypt. But he went further than required. He now dressed and behaved more like a king of Asia than a leader of Greeks. On top of that, he had married a Persian and started introducing Persian troops into his army. Alexander's intention was not to force Greek ways upon the Asians, but instead to create a fusion of Greek and Persian cultures, led by a newly forged ruling elite, so that centuries-old enemies could be finally reconciled. So in 324, back in Susa, he compelled over 90 Macedonian nobles to marry women from the Persian aristocracy in a massive joint wedding. The historian W.W. Tarn, writing just after the First World War, at a time when the League of Nations was being formed, heaped praise upon Alexander for transcending national differences in his attempts to create a union and harmony of mankind. But few historians today are in any way so generous. In fact, another way to look at Alexander is as a murderous tyrant with insatiable greed for power and conquest. According to Peter Green's book, Alexander the Great in the Hellenist Age, Alexander's expedition, quote, was fundamentally disruptive rather than constructive in any unifying sense. It began with an urgent need for booty and ended in megalomania. It took over an empire that had lasted for two long centuries, shattered its theocratic rationale, patched a Macedonian superstructure onto its administrative system, treated its accumulated wealth as fairy gold to be poured out at will, and looked no further than the grandiose personal ambitions of its leader. End quote. However noble or otherwise, Alexander's reforms were cut short before they got going. In June 323 BC, he caught a fever and died some days after. Alexander would never live to see the outcome of his invasion and social experiment. He had designated no heir, and his only son was not yet born. And so, after a series of civil wars, the conquered territory fractured into separate kingdoms, controlled by Macedonian generals, who were uninterested in the dream of a new, harmonious Greco-Persian culture. Thus started the so-called Hellenistic Age, a period when a Greek and Macedonian elite ran the Middle East from 323 BC until the late 1st century BC, when the Romans took over. During this time, many Greeks migrated to the east, where they helped maintain the preeminence of Greek customs. Also, many wealthy non-Greeks of the region adopted Greek habits and language, accommodating themselves to the new social hierarchy. At least within royal courts and urban centres, Greek became the regional lingua franca. One successor kingdom was the so-called Ptolemaic Kingdom of Egypt, founded by Ptolemy I, one of Alexander's closest companions. He and his descendants ruled as pharaoh until the very last pharaoh of Egypt, the famous Cleopatra. Another powerful Hellenistic state was the Seleucid Empire. At the height of its power, it occupied most of the old Persian Empire from Asia Minor to India, but eventually fell to Rome. The difficulty of assessing Alexander's legacy is that all of the complete surviving accounts were written more than 300 years after the events they describe. They were based on lost texts written by close associates of Alexander, which were skewed to glorify their king and bolster the author's own role in his success. We will never know if Alexander's plan to forge a new Greco-Persian state would have succeeded had he survived long enough to complete his project, and none of his successors tried to continue his ideas. Though perhaps by trying to bring together these two ancient cultures, he was trying to reconcile the irreconcilable. Despite this, Alexander's legacy was substantial. As I suggested in my introductory podcast, Europe is defined as much by culture as geography. Hellenistic culture thrived in the Middle East throughout the Roman and Byzantine periods until the Muslim conquest of the 7th century AD, and survived in pockets for many centuries after that. Had this culture survived longer in parts of the Middle East, it would have altered our perception of the boundaries of Europe. But it did not, and instead, it would turn out that Alexander's most lasting legacy is the influence of Greek culture on Rome, thanks to the later Roman conquest of first the Hellenistic kingdoms and later much of Europe. In my next podcast, I will tell of Rome's origins as one city-state among many others on the Italian peninsula and their rise to world power. The biggest milestone in this journey was the defeat of their archenemy, the Phoenicians, based on the opposite side of the Mediterranean, in Carthage. The conflict lasted decades, and at its climax fought head-to-head two of history's greatest generals, Scipio Africanus of Rome and Hannibal. Please join me in 2 weeks when I will cover the rise of Rome and Punic Wars, which culminated in the Battle of Zama.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.